Hello, and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. Some Jewish people are saying the Trump administration is politicizing the fight against anti-Semitism. We'll hear local reaction. The ongoing trade war between the U.S. and China has local business owners caught in the middle. And efforts to modernize and increase accessibility at the Circuit Court Clerk's Office. Now to some of today's top stories. Governor J.B. Pritzker is doubling down on comments this weekend where he called out, quote, do-nothing Democrats for failing to push back against the Trump administration. Pritzker made the initial comments at a speech for New Hampshire's Democratic Party where he attacked Trump while also noting shortcomings in his own party, like listening to political types instead of the American people. Today, he responded to reporters' questions about the speech.
Look, this is about the fact that that so much has not been accomplished that could have been. And the example I'd like to give you is that we've had for now, I think about 16 years, $7.25 minimum wage in the United States. As we have done in the state of Illinois, where we've raised the minimum wage to $15, we ought to be doing at least that at the federal level. And so from my mind, that is an example of something that instead of doing nothing, we ought to do something about. And that is what I'm calling for among Democrats.
Pritzker made the comments today at a University of Illinois Chicago rally against the Trump administration's targeting of universities. She may be 164 years old and weigh 2,000 pounds, but People's Gas says it's time to retire. The utility today removed and formally retired the natural gas main that had been running under Wabash Avenue since Abraham Lincoln became president the year the Civil War began, 1861. And so it's no hyperbole to say that this pipe has quite literally been through it all, through the Great Chicago Fire, through the rebirth of a city, and the city's natural evolution throughout its history and time and well into the 21st century. Over the years, the old cast iron pipe has provided gas services to Chicago icons like the Palmer House Hotel and Miller's Pub. But over time, old pipes leak, causing safety hazards and environmental damage. People's Gas says the newer plastic system reduces methane emissions by eliminating leaks. A new pilot project is looking to attack Chicago's rat problem at the source by using birth control instead of poison. The Wicker Park Bucktown Chamber of Commerce is currently testing rat contraception, and Lincoln Park is about to follow suit this summer with a pilot project of its own. Advocates say poison is becoming less effective in rats, but are lethal to other animals, including birds that prey on rats. Earlier attempts to use birth control for rats were not successful, but it was administered as a liquid. New versions have now been developed in pellet form. Stay tuned. Up next, the Trump administration threatens to defund elite universities, citing an increase in anti-Semitism. That's right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
President Donald Trump has made good on his promise to freeze federal funding to universities. He cites a rise in anti-Semitic attacks and institutions' inadequate response. While some Jewish people are skeptical of the administration's motivations, saying he's politicizing anti-Semitism, others are welcoming the administration's actions. Joining us to discuss this more are David Goldenberg, the Midwest Regional Director of the Anti-Defamation League, Owen Howard, a DePaul University graduate student and Jews for Justice president, Northwestern University legal professor Shauna Bernstein, and Rabbi David Chapman, Congregation Beth Shalom. Thanks to all of you for joining us. So, Shauna Bernstein, I want to start with you. Northwestern, as we know, it's now one of the federal government's targets. They have had $790 million in federal funding frozen. In your view, is this a fight about public safety and anti-Semitism and public safety for Jewish students in particular on university campuses, or is this part of the president's larger battle against higher ed?
That's a really important question, and I worry a lot about what's happening with this because I think that anti-Semitism is being misused for political purposes, and it's particularly hard to believe that an administration that has said certain things like the Charlottesville rally, there's, you know, good people on both sides, Jews will not replace us. We've seen Schumer's not really Jewish because of the way he does things. We've seen if Jews vote for Harris, they aren't really Jews, right? There's just a lot of things that make it hard to believe that anti-Semitism is really what they're after. I think it's also, you know, you think about J.D. Vance's public statements about universities being the enemy, and when you put those all together, it's just very hard to believe it. Well, I think focusing on anti-Semitism is important. It's hard for a lot of people, I think, that I know to understand and believe that that's actually what's going on rather than just dismantling universities.
Rabbi Chapman, same question to you.
Thanks for asking the question. I serve a community that has felt, not just felt, that has been unsafe and has, I've heard stories of college students that have been harassed and attacked and just trying to live their lives as students, and they haven't been able to pursue their studies in the way that they would like to. And so I think it's more than a perception, especially in the year and a half since October 7th, I think it's become a real critical issue. So look, I think it's complicated. I welcome any effort to seriously combat anti-Semitism. And at the same time, I also think that we have to remember that Jews are always safest in democracies where rule of law and justice is observed. So it's difficult for me to say which policy is or isn't the right policy or the wrong policy. I share some of the skepticism, but I also know that for our community, there's a real sense of urgency around safety on campus that, frankly, has not been taken seriously as it should have been up until now.
Okay, so to that point, David Goldenberg, an audit from ADL, you all found that in 2024, for the first time, a majority of all anti-Semitic incidents, that's more than 5,500 incidents, were related to Israel. Of all Israel-related incidents, nearly 2,600 took place at anti-Israel rallies in the form of anti-Semitic speeches, chants, signs, slogans. What do you think college campuses should be doing to push back against anti-Jewish attacks?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, I want to make clear, look, we tracked well over 5,000 anti-Israel rallies on college campuses, and roughly half of them made it into the audit, because well over 2,500 of them, we couldn't find acts of anti-Semitism that were part of those rallies. So it's important that on a college campus, freedom of speech, that ability exists, right? Like, that's an important place, and the First Amendment guarantees that right. And at the same time, on college campuses, when you have chants calling and celebrating violence against Jews anywhere and everywhere, where you have Jewish students who are being harassed, where you have Jewish students who are literally physically being attacked on college campuses from protests and events, that and speakers who are coming to campus who are really fanning the flames of anti-Semitism, it's a problem. And for universities, they need to have in place the policies and practices to make sure that they can respond when Jewish students are not attacked. Anti-Semitism should be protected under codes of conduct. And they also have a voice to say this is the expectation that all of our students are going to feel safe here on campus. And when those incidents occur, that they take aggressive action, including discipline and even expulsion if necessary, if there's a violation of codes of conduct targeting members of the Jewish community.
Do you see the president raising concerns, though, about anti-Semitism in any other sector the way he is about higher ed?
Look, we welcome any time a president or an elected official raises concerns about anti-Semitism, because as you speak to campus or other places, ADL has screamed from the rooftops about problems for years that universities have failed Jewish students and failed to take necessary action. So as it relates to the president and his motives, you've got to ask him. Look, I'm not on the red team, I'm not on the blue team, I'm on the Jewish team. And what I can tell you is that anti-Semitism has reached epidemic levels on college campuses, and we all need to do something about it.
Owen, you've been a DePaul student for about 6 years. What shift have you seen on campus going back to October 7th?
I don't really think I've seen much of a shift. I think that we've remained pretty stagnant. I think it really does depend what kind of communities you're in and also how you view anti-Semitism. I think that there is a concerted effort not only by individuals in our community, but by the administration, by universities all across the country to equate anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. I think on some level, there are adults, there are respected individuals in our communities organizations that are telling Jewish students they should be afraid and viewing these things or these actions as credible threats, while this is all really in the context after October 7th on a genocide that's happening. And we have to understand that Jewish safety, these are words, these are conversations that need to start at home. We need to have a conversation with all types of Jews, Jews of color, anti-Zionist Jews, Jews who do support Israel. We need to have real conversations with all of these people to best address anti-Semitism. But really, these protests, in my view, are a voice for a people who have been under siege for almost 100 years.
Rabbi Chapman, what are you hearing from your congregants?
I'm hearing from congregants who they themselves are college students or their kids or grandkids are college students that they have felt unsafe. They've felt unsafe for a long time in various settings and campuses. I remember when I was a college student, which was quite a while ago, long before October 7th, I sometimes felt unsafe for expressing a view of support for Israel or even just expressing my Jewish identity in different settings. So I don't think it's an illusion. I think it really is happening, and I think it's something that does give me as a religious leader a lot of concern. And I am also hearing from congregants that are concerned about a lack of due process, about sliding away from democracy and transparency, and that is troubling as well. You know, we teach a religion and we revere in the Torah a system of laws and justice and a system of fairness and transparency, and I think that is really important too. When you look at Jewish history, again, those are the settings in which Jews have been most safe, as settings where rule of law and democracy is respected.
Shauna, can you think of a moment in history that resembles this moment, sort of the what some people are calling the politicization or weaponization of racial or religious identity?
Not directly, but I think part of what's happening in my mind with using anti-Semitism in this way, despite the real concerns that there are that we should have about anti-Semitism, is it's over the centuries there have been attempts by people in power to separate groups of people, to keep them from seeing their common needs, right? The fact that there's racism and sexism and anti-Semitism. So like Bacon's Rebellion, 1676, enslaved black people, indentured white servants rose up, and the black codes were the response by people with power to say, we're going to make sure that black people and white people don't realize they have anything in common. And I don't think we've seen anything like this weaponization of anti-Semitism before, but we have seen a repeated and ongoing use of differences among groups of people to try to push a wedge between them. And I'm afraid that that's what's happening here. And I worry when we say anti-Semitism is a problem, let's bring in these efforts and kneecap universities because, you know, what they've done. First of all, it's bad for Jews because anti-Semitism, I think, is going to be stimulated by these kinds of actions. I worry about that. I also think that at the moment, Jews are the cause that people are, like the administration is saying they care about. What happens when that's no longer the case and then other groups become, you know, the cause célèbre and Jews become the target. So I think it's a dangerous route to go down.
About a minute left, David mm-hmm. Goldenberg, there's some concern that anti-Zionist speech or critiques of Israel can be confused or conflated with anti-Semitism. How can people tell the difference between legitimate, you know, political expression versus anti-Jewish sentiment?
Yeah. Look, like any thriving democracy, criticizing Israeli policy is actually kind of who we are as a Jewish community. You're not going to find someone who criticizes Israeli policy, arguably more than me. And at the same time, though, when you're out there calling for the elimination of the state of Israel, which is what you're seeing at some of these rallies, that's an extreme view. 90% of Americans think that Israel should exist as a safe haven for the Jewish people. Almost 90% of American Jews identify and believe that there should be a Jewish homeland and a safe haven. Those who don't and don't make that equation are sitting largely on the extremes of our own community. So when you're out there calling for the elimination of Israel, that's a problem. When you're calling for violence against Jews, that's where you've crossed the line as well. And when you're ultimately suggesting that Jews are more loyal to Israel than that we are to our home country, that also is anti-Semitic. And so we see all of that in all these rallies.
It sounds like you feel like there's a pretty clear line when it's said out loud.
Very clear demarcation.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there. My thanks to all of you for joining us. Thanks to our guests, David Goldenberg, Owen Howard, Shauna Bernstein, and Rabbi David Chapman. Up next, we hear from shop owners in Chinatown who are caught in the middle of a trade war. The U.S.-China trade war has been ratcheting up for nearly a month now. President Donald Trump first announced new tariffs on almost all U.S. trading partners in early April, with China becoming the main target. Taxes on Chinese imports are currently sitting at 145%. Beijing has retaliated with tariffs of its own, taxing American goods 125%. Local shop owners in Chicago's Chinatown community are bracing for the consequences of the ongoing feud. Here's producer Shelby Hawkins with the story.
Leo Li opened Grace Grocery Store 9 years ago, shortly after moving to Chicago. His shop operates as both a grocery and a gift shop. He estimates about 95% of his products are Chinese imports.
但是我们发现很多的批发公司或者进口商，他们目前也面临的缺货的问题，因为他们也不知道未来的关税会增加到什么程度，然后对他们的进口商的冲击是什么样的影响。
In addition to protecting his business from tariffs, Li also finds himself defending his situation to friends and family back in China.
但是对于他们向我们问的一些问题，我们也好像也不好
Tariffs implemented by the Trump administration are expected to raise prices and affect more than just shop owners in Chinatown. It could put a strain on other industries like toy manufacturing, farming, and steel. Domestic and global stock markets have taken a downward turn since the back and forth tariffs started. And the uncertainty makes Sea Cucumber City Manager Ina Lei a little nervous.
佢關税升咗咧，我哋嘅價錢肯定會升翻少少咯，因為你逼緊關税升係中間商嗰啲問題咧，都我哋都會有升啊，對啲商家嘅整體都係好大嘅影響。
Sea Cucumber City sells traditional Chinese medicines, dried seafoods, and candies. They've been operating for 3 years.
呢間鋪對於唐人街啲人民嚟講咧，都係即係重要性都好大，因為佢可以買到好多關於中國嘅藥材啦，同埋關於所有嘅送禮雞品啦，仲有好多零食啦，即係可以解決一大部分人嘅思鄉嘅感情咯。Chinese
President Xi Jinping has warned other countries against making trade deals with the U.S. Meanwhile, President Trump is pressuring other nations to isolate China, leaving business owners caught in the middle.
以作我们三家的观点出发，当然是不希望关税加得太高，因为如果关税加得高，我们适当的提价也会对大家的消费力造成影响。我们还是希望关税能够，就是说在可接受的范围，大家互惠互利。
For Chicago Tonight, I'm Shelby Hawkins.
And there's more of this story on our website. The Cook County Circuit Court Clerk may not be a political office you're very familiar with. They're charged with managing court records and court orders and serving more than 400 judges across Chicago and Cook County. And just a few months into her term, Clerk Mariana Spiropoulos is out with a new progress report. Joining us now with some of the report's takeaways is Mariana Spiropoulos, Clerk of the Circuit Court of Cook County. Welcome to Chicago Tonight. Thanks for joining
us. Thanks for having me on the show, Brandon.
So you reached 100 days in office last month, roughly 150 days this week. What were your priorities coming into the position?
Well, I ran on transparency, accessibility, and accountability. And those are sort of the pillars that everything that we've focused on in the office have to run through those values. For example, transparency, we want to make sure that people know what we're doing. So we established the first ever data dashboard, so you can see how many cases have been initiated, what areas of law, what locations. And as people give us their feedback on that, we'll be changing and developing that. But like I said, this is the first time that's ever been done. And in terms of accessibility, we want to make sure people can access the court system and the services that we provide. We have a lot of forms. We've got language access, because it can be an intimidating process if you're going to go through the court system. So we want to make sure there's that language accessibility. You can get all kinds of data through our record center on our website. You can also plea and pay your tickets on our website. And we're going to develop, we're in the process of developing an app, so you'll be able to navigate the court system on your phone as well.
Okay. What were some of the errors your office found? I think there was reports that when you got into office, there was some work that you found that had not been done.
Just a little bit. We found a little bit in terms of accounting. So, for example, we have to do a lot of reporting. We do a lot of data collection, and we have to do reporting to the Supreme Court of Illinois, the Administrative Office of Illinois Courts, and Cook County as well. As you can imagine, we initiate cases and we collect that information, so we have to put it in reports. So there's specific data reporting. Office of the Chief Judge also uses our information. So that hadn't been done in 2023 and 2024. So we caught up and made sure that our staff was dedicated to that, catching up on what we have to report. Also in terms of accounting, making sure that our house is in order in terms of the finances. There's fines and fees we're collecting. We also have a huge budget. So I want to make sure I hired the right people who have expertise in accounting, and they can take care of that. And so, you know, there's a lot on our plate, but we're doing, I think, a great job, and I've got a great team dedicated to that.
You mentioned, of course, creating the county's first public-facing data dashboard.
Yes.
Currently, it goes back to 2020. What are the plans to continue adding?
So, again, as we see people requiring different information, we're open to that. We want to develop that site. We see it as like a living site in terms of responding what people's needs are. If they want to see other information, we'll start looking into that and to see how we can provide for that.
Okay. You're planning a push for legislation that would bring your office under the state's FOIA law, the Freedom of Information Act law. Why wasn't your office, and I know you've only been there for a few months, so this is not your department yet, but why wasn't this office already under the state's FOIA?
So I can't speak to what the previous administration did. We are certainly dedicated to the freedom of information. And we will be providing that information and are currently doing that through our data dashboard, through our records center. Like I said, you can ask for all kinds of information and documents from our office through our online site. So we're going to continue to provide that, and we'll be having the conversations with state legislatures in order to get some kind of legislation going forward. But it'll take time. It's a process, and we have to have a lot of conversations about that.
You currently have an internal inspector general that you've appointed, but you've said that you plan to bring your office under the county's IG. What's the status of that plan?
So the plan was to see what the county IG looked like and what the relationship is, what the dynamic is, to make sure that we have oversight. I've hired the head of my inspector general is someone from COPA, from the city. And they have a lot of experience in terms of investigative experience. And we also put out a customer service survey. So any of those results go directly to our inspector general in case there's something that needs to be investigated. So if the public has any compliments or complaints, all of that goes directly to the inspector general to make sure that we're looking into any problems that are arising.
And to that customer service survey, the stuff that doesn't need to be investigated, what are you hearing from residents?
We're hearing, good things. We've got some great staff. They've been there for a long time. There's a lot of institutional knowledge. We have provided customer service training so that our staff can handle any kind of scenario that might be coming up, try to diffuse emotional situations if necessary, but just making sure that we're providing a professional, respectful type of environment for people to come into the court system.
What's next? What about the next 150 days? What are your priorities?
We're excited because we want to develop something called e-citations. And what that means is you would have electronic ticketing. So some of the suburbs have it right now, but it's not synced up to our software, so we don't get it in real time. And then we'll be talking to the Chicago Police Department to make sure that we can get them on board with electronic ticketing as well.
How would that work beyond what we already know about, like, speed and red light camera tickets?
Well, the city of Chicago handles those. We do moving violations, but in terms of the ticketing, it's really just the process in terms of getting that data right away. So, for example, if you got a moving violation or a ticket, you wanted to pay it right away. If you came in the next day, we wouldn't have it into our data, electronic ticketing would get it immediately.
Much
you'd
quicker.
Be able to pay it. Yeah.
Yay for tickets. Okay. Circuit Court Clerk Mariana Spiropoulos, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Brandis.
And that is our show for this Monday night. Join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that serves the needs of clients in the Chicago area and throughout the nation.